Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 990, Hindutva of Fascism, part 3, Modi Operandi. This is being recorded on January 2nd of the year 2018. Well, I would perhaps wish listeners a happy new year. I certainly hope that the new year for you individually turns out to be happy. However, I am extremely pessimistic about the prospects for humanity and the planet in general. So rather than go, oh, wow, happy new year, everybody, boo, is my party whistle, I think I'm just going to get down to business. Now, in this program, we are going to be continuing our analysis, as the title indicates, of Hindutva fascism. That is H-I-N-D-U-T, as in Thomas, V as in Victor, A. In the first two programs, we discussed the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. That was executed, quite literally, by the RSS. That is a Hindu nationalist slash fascist organization, or Hindutva fascist organization, that demonizes Muslims, that seeks to make India a Hindu nation, unquote, and that also draws on a political mythology that is held in common not only by many in India, but also by the more esoteric elements of Nazism and the SS in particular. We will talk more about that in our next show. We've spoken about that with Peter in our discussions with Peter Lavenda, and also in some of our discussions with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, a must-read for anyone who is serious on remaining abreast of contemporary fascism. The party, the Hindutva fascist party that murdered Gandhi, the RSS, along with its military wing, the Hindu Mahasabha, had deeply infiltrated Indian security forces and ultimately spawned a political front, the BJP. That is the party of Narendra Modi, the current Prime Minister of India. And Modi and the BJP and the RSS, for which the BJP is a front, are implementing the Hindutva fascist program of the RSS. I would note that India is not only the second most populous country on Earth and the third largest country geographically, it has been historically the world's largest democracy. That, however, is fading into the past behind the Hindutva fascism of the RSS and the BJP. In this program, we are going to be taking a look at Modi's appointment of Yogi Adityanath, an RSS member in his youth and a virulently and outspokenly anti-Muslim activist. The fascism of the RSS, Hindutva fascism, like many strains of fascism, most, in my opinion, demonizes the other. In this case, the 170 million Muslims who are still resident in India, even after the partition of India into Pakistan and the British colony of India into Pakistan and contemporary India. Yogi Adityanath is, again, virulently anti-Muslim, and he has also put together a Hindu youth brigade, sort of a Hindutva fascist, like a cross between the Hitlerjugend and the SA. and they ride motorcycles and are militantly and verbally murderously anti-Muslim. As we will see later, there has been a series of killings in India, not only of outspoken journalists, but in particular journalists like Gauri Lankesh, who were not only critical of the RSS as being fascist and critical of Modi, but who had the capacity to mobilize the Dalit, or untouchables, as they are also called in India. They are the lowest rung on the socioeconomic ladder, traditionally known as untouchables. The untouchables were one of the focal points of Mahatma Gandhi's political agenda. Raising their status was one thing he sought to do. In India, Modi's BJP has been seeking to corral the Dalit vote, and Gauri Lankesh and a number of other activists and journalists who were murdered with the same weapon that killed Gauri Lankesh had been seen as capable of mobilizing and organizing the Dalit, again that's D-A-L-I-T, or untouchables, into a coalition that could oppose the Hindutva fascism of Narendra Modi. India is descending into a more or less overtly repressive political agenda with freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and omnipresent surveillance. We will talk about that. And Modi himself has apparently benefited from something that has become only too familiar here in the U.S., namely the manipulation of electronic voting machines. When Modi's BJP won the local elections in Uttar Pradesh, they did so by carrying the Muslim districts in Uttar Pradesh. That's U-T-T-A-R-P-R-A-D-E-S-H. And that is extremely unlikely. And as one critic pointed out, it is almost certainly indicative of tapping or manipulation of electronic voting machines. We are also going to note something. We're going to conclude with a couple of really grotesque, although relatively superficial elements. One of the things Mahatma Gandhi was noted for was spinning. Part of that, and there's a good portrayal of this in the award-winning motion picture Gandhi from 1982, garnered many Oscars. Part of the British colonial agenda for India was to force the citizens or the members of the colony of India to purchase cloth from British textile makers. This was at the expense, literally, of much of the Indian community. And so what Gandhi did was to launch a program, very successful, in which Indians would spin their own cloth, and he himself would spin his cloth into a loincloth, in which he was, which frequently was his only attire. And this was a very successful device for enabling Indians to circumvent the imposed textile purchasing agenda of the Raj, or British colonial masters. The pictures of Gandhi with a spinning wheel are among the best known images of Gandhi that have survived historically. And Modi himself has appropriated that and has posed as, had himself published in the calendar with a spinning wheel, something that outraged many people in India. But it is quite obviously an attempt by Modi to conflate his image with that of Gandhi, who is still seen correctly as the father of the Indian nation. And that is altogether grotesque, not only because Modi's BJP is, again, a political cat's paw for the RSS, the Hindutva fascist organization that murdered Gandhi, as we have seen in our last two shows. But Modi himself was photographed during a state trip by President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. Modi was photographed in a $16,000 pinstripe suit that was given to him by a wealthy supporter. The pinstripes, they were gold in color, were actually his name. And when people noted this, saying that Modi, on the one hand, was trying to represent himself as the son of a humble tea salesman, and then he's going around in a $16,000 suit, this from a guy who is trying to equate his image with that of Gandhi, who was frequently attired only in a loincloth that he made himself from homespun fabric. When critics scored Modi for wearing a $16,000 suit, he then put it up for auction, and it sold for something like $695,000. And so, although relatively superficial, the grotesque contrast between Modi posing himself as Gandhi, whereas he is the political leader of the political forces that killed Gandhi, that is grotesque enough. But then for him to be photographed in a $16,000 suit and then to auction that for $695,000, well, it is quite remarkable. One wants to, I think, be hesitant about equating too readily various types of fascism. I would note, however, in the U.S., Donald Trump, for example, and he's only one example, has been quite successful about masking his elitist economic agenda or corporatist economic agenda by basically mobilizing people's fear and resentment of the other, whether it's black people or, quote, immigrants, unquote, or Mexicans, or gays, or whoever. And Trump has been quite successful in deflecting the attention from his openly elitist agenda, exemplified by the recent tax bill, which will benefit Trump and his kids. And basically, it's let them eat fascism, or let them eat resentment. And many of the people who are being deflected by that political agenda are people relatively far down the economic food chain. So too in India, the Dalits, or untouchables, are at the very bottom of the socioeconomic ladder in India, and yet Modi has been working to mobilize them to generate support. And it, again, with Modi running around in $16,000 suits and yet trying to posing himself with a spinning wheel a la Gandhi, it's not, in certain respects, unlike the way Donald Trump has been quite successfully portraying himself as the everyman of American politics. So that is something to consider.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We're going to begin by taking a look at Modi's appointment of Yogi, that's Y-O-G-I, Adityanath. He has been appointed as the governor of Uttar Pradesh, that's Uttar Pradesh. That is not only India's most populous province, but it also, the governor of Uttar Pradesh is seen as being a key candidate for ultimately becoming prime minister. The chief minister of Uttar Pradesh is seen as a very likely successor to Narendra Modi. Now, as far as Yogi Adityanath, he falls right in the tradition of the RSS and the forces that killed Gandhi, as we looked at in For the Record 988 and For the Record 989. From the New York Times of July 12th of 2017, an article by Ellen Berry, B-A-R-R-Y, and Suhasini Raj, S-U-H-A-S-I-N-I-R-A-J. Firebrand Hindu cleric ascends India's political ladder. And after talking about the asceticism that has been the populist calling card of Yogi Adityanath, the authors note, Adityanath, born Ajay, A-J-A-Y, Singh, S-I-N-G-H, B-I-S-H-T, Beast, found his vocation in college as an activist in the student wing of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, a right-wing Hindu organization. Now, bear in mind, this is the New York Times. They are not going to label this as it should be labeled, fascist. They will call it right-wing or populist. And Adityanath is, well, his political agenda can be summed up as follows. As leader of a temple known for its militant Hindu supremacist tradition, Adityanath has built an army of youths intent on avenging historic wrongs by Muslims, whom he has called, quote, a crop of two-legged animals that has to be stopped, unquote. At one rally, he cried out, quote, we are all preparing for religious war, unquote. And the article goes on to comment, Adityanath was an astonishing choice by Narendra Modi, India's prime minister, who came into office 3 years ago promising to usher India into a new age of development and economic growth, and playing down any far-right Hindu agenda. But a populist drive to transform India into a, quote, Hindu nation, unquote, has ground out Mr. Modi's development agenda, shrinking the economic and social space for the country's 170 million Muslims. And again, note that the governor of Uttar Pradesh, or the chief minister, as the title is formally known, is seen as the front-runner to succeed or to become prime minister. Returning to that New York Times article from July 12th of this, not this year, but 2017, few decisions in Indian politics matter more than the selection of the chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, because the post is seen as a springboard for future prime ministers. At the age of 45, the diminutive, baby-faced Adityanath is receiving the kind of career-making attention that projects an Indian politician toward higher office. And I would note that the temple with which he was associated had a head priest who had been jailed for advocating the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi. We looked at Hindutva fascism and the circumstances surrounding the killing of Gandhi in our last two programs. And so Adityanath, his political and religious traditions basically are directly in line with that dynamic. Returning to the New York Times article, he was so engrossed in the RSS group's work that the first two or three times he was summoned by a distant relative, the head priest of the Goraknath Temple, G-O-R-A-K-H-N-A-T-H Temple, he could not find the time, he has said. But religion and politics were fast converging. Goraknath Temple had a tradition of militancy. Digjivay, not N-A-T-H, the head priest until 1969, was arrested for exhorting Hindu militants to kill Mahatma Gandhi days before he was shot. His successor, Mahant Avaidyanath, A-V-A-I-D-Y-A-N-A-T-H, urged Hindu mobs in 1992 to tear down a 16th century mosque and build a temple there, setting off some of the bloodiest religious riots in India's recent history. And that last priest's name again, MahantAvaidYanath. And so again, with the religious slash political history of Yogi Adityanath, we see the very same forces that we examined in our most recent couple of programs, the Hindutva fascist Hindu militants who ultimately successfully murdered Gandhi and who had their act effectively covered up. Analysis of this in the New York Times by someone who monitors the Indian affairs for the American Enterprise Institute, quote, speaking of Yogi Adityanath and the selection of him to be chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, quote, he is automatically on anybody's list as a potential contender to succeed Modi, said Sadanand, S-A-D-A-N-A-N-D, Dhume, D-H-U-M-E, an India specialist at the American Enterprise Institute. Quote, they have normalized someone who 3 years ago was considered too extreme to be Minister of State for Textiles. Everything has been normalized so quickly. Well, indeed it has, and we've seen that not only in the U.S., but elsewhere as well. Now, for people that may think that discussion of India as fascist, and again, India has been the world's most populous democracy with a little over a billion citizens, consider the following, and again, this is from the New York Times, which, although America's paper of record, generally can be handicapped somewhat to the left, or in many cases, extremely far to the left. It is the CIA's number one propaganda asset. And from the New York Times Western Edition, or West Coast Edition, of October 27th of last year, 2017, an article by Mira, actually an op-ed column by Mira, M-I-R-A, Kandar, K-A-N-D-A-R. And by the way, I am probably almost certainly mispronouncing many of these Indian names, if not all of them. The question more Indians ask, is my phone tapped? And again, if my characterization of what Modi is doing in India as fascist seems off base, a businessman told me he had stopped going online to buy books that the government might frown upon because he was afraid officials would track his purchases. There's good reason for such fears, another businessman said. You go to a party where there are a dozen people you've known for years. Someone says something mildly critical of the government, and then you learn that the person's office was paid a visit the next day by the income tax authorities. These were not reflections on life in some police state. These were conversations I had this month during a visit to India, a country I have been visiting for nearly 60 years. It is no secret that attacks on freedom of expression have accelerated since the election of Prime Minister Narendra Modi in May of 2014. Yet nothing prepared me for the pervasive anxieties I encountered on this trip. While freedom of speech has never been an absolute right in India, I always thought that this raucous democracy would ultimately overcome any blanket effort to quash dissent, as it did when Prime Minister Indira Gandhi declared a state of emergency and clamped down on the news media in 1975. But I was stunned when a well-known writer in New Delhi confided that she and others used encrypted communications. Quote, we're all on Proton Mail and Signal at this point, she said. Others said they only communicated on WhatsApp. Quote, all our phones are tapped, declared a news editor in Mumbai. As the comments from the businessman indicate, the fears I heard weren't limited to journalists and writers disinclined to support Mr. Modi. People who had appreciated the pro-business elements of his candidacy and who still have hope for his economic policies expressed similar concerns. Journalists, though, have particular reason for fear. In June, the Central Bureau of Investigation raided residences and offices connected to the founders of NDTV, an influential cable TV station and online news outlet that has had run-ins with Mr. Modi's government. The Editors Guild of India and leading media figures condemned the raid, but the magazine editor confided, quote, "Of course, we are all afraid. They could go after anyone in our family at any time," unquote. Even more disturbing have been a series of unsolved murders of journalists and punitive legal actions against the news media. The online news outlet The Wire was slapped with a criminal defamation suit after it published a story this month alleging that Jay Shah, that's J-A-Y-S-H-A-H, son of Amit A-M-I-T Shah, the powerful head of Mr. Modi's governing BJP, has profited handsomely under Mr. Modi's government. Then, last week, a court in Gujarat where Mr. Modi was formerly chief minister barred the news outlet from publishing any stories directly or indirectly about Jay Shah until the lawsuit was resolved. Defiant, The Wire posted a photo of the order vowing, quote, "It goes without saying that this attempt to gag The Wire will not go unchallenged," unquote. On Monday, the BJP-led government in Rajasthan state introduced an ordinance in the state's legislative assembly that would essentially bar reporting of government malfeasance by requiring government permission to investigate, quote, "both serving and former judges, magistrates, and public servants for on-duty actions," unquote. It will also make it illegal to, quote, "print or publish or publicize in any manner the name, address, photograph, family details, or any other particulars which may lead to disclosure of identity of a judge or magistrate or a public servant against whom an investigation is pending." Not all of the Indians I spoke to were so uneasy. Many citizens remain outspoken. Courageous journalists continue to do their job, but the growing fear of Indians to speak, to write, and even to read freely poses a grave threat to one of the world's greatest democracies. Yes, it does. And as noted in that article, these murders of journalists, and we're about to turn to that, are not only unsolved, but the murders of journalists and activists who were seen as possibly being able to mobilize the Dalit, again, that's capital D-A-L-I-T, or Untouchables, as they are also called, the lowest socioeconomic caste in India. These were people seen as being able to mobilize the Dalits in an anti-Modi, anti-BJP, anti-RSS fashion.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
And going to the killing of Gauri Lankesh, that is the journalist about whom we are going to speak right now. Again, from the New York Times, this from the New York Times of September 6th of 2017, an article by Jeffrey, J-E-F-F-R-A-Y, Gethelman, G-E-T-T-L-E-M-A-N, and Hari, H-A-R-I, Kumar, K-U-M-A-R. In India, another government critic is silenced by bullets. And this is about the killing of Gauri, G-A-U-R-I, Lankesh, L-A-N-K-E-S-H. And skipping down in this, Gauri Lankesh, one of India's most outspoken journalists, was walking into her house on Tuesday night. It was around 8 p.m. The night was warm, and she was alone. As she stepped through her gate just feet from her front door, several gunshots rang out. She was killed instantly in what political opposition officials say appears to be yet another assassination of an intellectual who publicly criticized India's governing party and the Hindu agenda it has pursued. In recent years, at least three other anti-establishment activists have been silenced by bullets. Anybody who speaks against the RSS, BJP, is attacked and even killed, Rahul Gandhi, an opposition leader, said in a Twitter message. They want to impose only one ideology, which is against the nature of India. The three other activists, killed in a somewhat similar manner in the past 4 years, have also opposed the rise of hardline Hinduism. On Monday, the day before Gauri Lankesh was killed, she shared a post on her Facebook page that was written by someone else. The RSS is the terrorist organization, it read. And as we are going to see, not only are there similarities in the methodology of the killing of Gauri Lankesh and a number of other activists, but the same gun, a 7.65-millimeter pistol, was used. I would note that if, in fact, there is ever an arrest made in these killings, the fact that the same weapon was used, something that I found somewhat puzzling at first, why would they use the same weapon? And then, as I thought about it, this would enable the fallout from the assassinations to be pinned on a lone nut. Well, it wasn't some institutional effort on the part of the RSS and the BJP or the Hindu Youth Brigade of Yogi Adityanath. No, this was a lone nut who used the same weapon. I would note that the methodology in these killings, in addition to the fact that the same weapon was involved, the killers rode up on motorbikes with their faces hidden by motorcycle helmets, thereby disguising their identity. As you can see in the picture in the written description to the show, the Hindu Youth Brigade of Yogi Adityanath features people riding on motorbikes and brandishing swords. So using motorbikes as propulsion is something that the Hindu Youth Brigade, sort of a Hindutva brown shirt organization founded by Yogi Adityanath, member of the RSS, devotee of a temple founded or headed up by priests who were jailed for threatening the life of Mahatma Gandhi, and someone who has openly called for religious war against Hindus, someone who may succeed Modi as prime minister. His Hindutva fascist brown shirts are basically using motorbikes to get around. I don't think it is a reach to ask whether perhaps those motorbikes figure in some way in the assassinations we are going to discuss. From the Indian Express of September 14th of 2017, we find the following article by Johnson T.A. The headline, "Gun used to kill Gauri Lankesh is the same one that killed M.M. Kalburgi. Forensics." And excerpting this, "A preliminary forensic analysis of bullets and cartridges found at the site of the September 5th shooting of journalist and activist Gauri," again, G-A-U-R-I, Lankesh, L-A-N-K-E-S-H, "and those recovered from the killing of Kannada research scholar M.M. Kalburgi 2 years ago, has revealed that the same 7.65-millimeter country-made pistol was used for both killings." This finding has been communicated to the special investigation team that is probing the murder of the 55-year-old journalist and activist, parenthetically Ms. Lankesh. Sources involved with the two separate investigations have told the Indian Express. By the way, Kannada, K-A-N-N-A-D-A, and M. Kalburgi, and the M's are as indicated, and his last name, K-A-L-B-U-R-G-I. So again, the ballistics reveal that the same gun was used in both killings, and beyond that, the methodology is quite similar as well. And we also learn that the same gun was used in other killings as well. Another article from the Indian Express, this from September 12th, 2017, also from Johnson T.A., as in Thomas Apple. Probe finds clues that point to link between Gauri Lankesh and M.M. Kalburgi killing. Investigations have revealed that the mechanics of the crime in the September 5th killing of journalist and activist Gauri Lankesh, 55, by an unidentified gunman, is identical to that of the August 30th, 2015 murder of Kannada literary scholar M.M. Kalburgi in Dharwad in northern Karnataka. More than one official familiar with the probe into Lankesh's killing said that although the investigation remained open in terms of tracking down the killers, and formal forensics and ballistics reports are awaited, there has been a significant finding, unquote, that suggests a link between the killings of Kalburgi and Lankesh. And even more importantly, skipping down, scholar and rationalist Kalburgi was shot dead at his home at 8:40 a.m. by two unidentified persons who drove up on a motorcycle. The assailants knocked on the door of the home of the 77-year-old Sahitya Akademi Award winner and shot him on the doorstep with two bullets from a 7.65-millimeter country-made pistol. Lankesh was shot dead in the front yard of her home at 8 p.m. on September 5th by one of two persons who came on a motorcycle and fired four bullets from a 7.65-millimeter country-made pistol while she was opening the gates to her home. Investigations in the Kalburgi murder case by the Karnataka Criminal Investigation Department revealed that the 7.65-millimeter pistol used to kill the rationalist was the same one used to murder 81-year-old Maharashtra rationalist and leftist thinker Govind, G-O-V-I-N-D, Pansari, P-A-N-S-A-R-E, in Kolhapur on February 16, 2015, by two unidentified men. The forensic analysis had also revealed that one of the two guns used to shoot down Pansari in 2015 had also been used to kill Maharashtra rationalist Narendra Dabholkar, D-A-B-H-O-L-K-A-R, 69, in Pune, or Pune, P-U-N-E, on August 30th, 2013, by a pair of unidentified men. This last passage again, because note that the same gun was used to kill M.M. Kalburgi as was used to kill Gauri Lankesh, and in both cases the assassin rode up on a motorcycle with his features hidden from view by the motorcycle helmet. And again, the Hindu Youth Brigade, founded by Yogi Adityanath, favor motorcycles as the motorbikes, as the picture in the written description shows quite clearly. That is not, of course, conclusive, but it certainly would suggest an investigative pathway between the killings. One more time. Scholar and rationalist M.M. Kalburgi was shot dead at his home at 8:40 a.m. by two unidentified persons who drove up on a motorcycle. The assailants knocked on the door of the home of the 77-year-old Sahitya, S-A-H-I-T-Y-A, Akademi, A-K-A-D-E-M-I, award winner, and shot him on the doorstep with two bullets from a 7.65-millimeter country-made pistol. Lancash was shot dead in the front yard of her home at 8 p.m. on September 5th by one of two persons who came on a motorcycle and fired four bullets from a 7.65-millimeter country-made pistol while she was opening the gates to her home. Investigations in the Kalburgi murder case by the Karnataka Criminal Investigation Department had revealed that the 7.65-millimeter pistol used to kill the rationalist was the same one that was used to murder 81-year-old Maharashtra rationalist and leftist thinker Govind, G-O-V-I-N-D, Pansari, P-A-N-S-A-R-E, in Kolhapur on February 16, 2015, by two unidentified men. The forensic analysis had also revealed that one of the two guns used to shoot down Pansari in 2015 had also been used to kill Maharashtra rationalist Narendra Dabholkar, again D-A-B-H-O-L-K-A-R, in Pune, P-U-N-E, on August 30th, 2013, by a pair of unidentified men. So again, Gauri Lankesh, M.M. Kalburgi, Govind Pansari, and Narendra Dabholkar, all killed with the same weapon, although in the killing of Dabholkar, there was another weapon as well. Now, at first, I thought this was methodologically clumsy. I mean, why would they use the same weapon? And yet, if the killings ever do unravel from an investigative standpoint, this will permit the limiting of the attribution of the crime to a lone nut. Recall that in our discussion of the assassination of Gandhi, Nathuram Godse and an associate were ultimately convicted and hanged for the killing, but V.D. Savarkar, the head of the RSS, and the prime mover behind the killing of Gandhi, and the man who had programmed, basically, Nathuram Godse, his personal secretary for the killing, remained not only unindicted, but basically he was able to turn around the investigation and have his protege, Godse, deliver a nine-hour indictment of Mahatma Gandhi. Ultimately, Savarkar was not only acquitted, but when the BJP came to power years later, he was lionized as a hero of India and something of an Indian historical and political hero. Now, the next article that we're going to go into talks about why Gauri Lankesh may have been killed and also notes that many of the other assassinations, those of Mr. Kalburgi and Mr. Pansari and Mr. Kalburgi, were of people who were seen as having the potential to mobilize the Dalit vote, again, D-A-L-I-T, or untouchable vote, the lowest socioeconomic caste in India, against Modi. And in turn, Modi's potential continued electoral success will depend in part on successfully mobilizing the Dalit vote. This article from, again, the New York Times of September 13th of 2017. Why was Gauri Lankesh killed? This by Sudipto, S-U-D-I-P-T-O, Mondal, M-O-N-D-A-L. And talking about this. In August 2013, the activist Narendra Dabholkar, who campaigned against religious superstitions, was murdered. In August of 2015, M.M. Kalburgi, a scholar and outspoken critic of idol worship among Hindus, was gunned down at his own doorstep. In February 2015, Govind Pansari, a communist leader, community organizer, and columnist, was killed in a small town near Mumbai. Mr. Dabholkar, Mr. Kalburgi, and Mr. Pansari were murdered by assassins on motorbikes, who hid their faces with helmets and fled after the murder. Exactly in the same manner that Ms. Lankesh was killed. The murdered intellectuals also wrote in regional languages and worked as activists. Each of them shared the quality of being acceptable to the leftist groups as well as the Dalit groups. They could mobilize and bring together communities opposed to the Hindu right. And that, again, is something that I think bears serious consideration in the motivation for the killings of these various activists. And again, the same weapons were used and in many cases the same methodology as well.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
An article from Slate of July 18th of 2017, this by Miran, M-E-E-R-A-N, Karim, K-A-R-I-M. India's presidential election proves the value of exploiting caste politics. And excerpting this article, caste, in short, remains perhaps the single most influential factor in Indian politics, despite rapid modernization of the world's largest democracy, as proven in the latest presidential contest. And Narendra Modi, who won a landslide victory by widening the party's appeal beyond the orthodox Hindu class, is sure to milk it for all it's worth. Even though it has campaigned on preserving conservative Hindu traditions, including sanctity of upper caste Brahmins, the BJP is dependent on the votes of the Dalits or Untouchables and other lower castes to win crucial states. In the state of Bihar, B-I-H-A-R, the third most populous state, Modi and the BJP suffered a demoralizing defeat to the rival RJD party, Rashtriya Janata Dal party, in 2015 state assembly elections. Bihar's lower caste communities voted heavily in support of RJD and its leader Lalu LALU Prasad PRASAD Yadav YADAV, who was able to strike a fruitful electoral alliance between Bihar's Muslims and the state's marginalized cow-herding Yadav caste. In March, the right-wing Hindu party secured a major victory in India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh, winning over the state's lower caste votes. Modi steered clear of potentially divisive language in his speeches, and the party was reported to have inducted members of the lower caste in leadership positions. Not surprisingly, Modi and the BJP are continuing this trend with the latest nomination of Ram Nath Kovind for president. So again, although devoted to preserving the traditional Indian caste system, at the same time with the promise of economic development, in this regard, not altogether dissimilar from the political rhetoric and ostensible agenda of Donald Trump, Modi has successfully won over at least some elements of the Dalit vote, but others apparently remain recalcitrant. So again, note that the many activists and journalists whose murders we just discussed, Mr. Kalburgi, Pansari, and others, as well as Gauri Lankesh, were seen as potentially capable of uniting the Dalits and other lower castes, as well as more liberal and leftist groups against Modi's agenda. And they were killed not only in similar fashion, but at least one of the weapons used in all of the killings was the same gun, permitting any investigation to be limited to a single individual or perhaps two lone nuts. This past story, this past article that I just excerpted again from Slate Magazine of July 18th of 2017 by Miriam Karim, India's presidential election proves the value of exploiting caste politics. Now, another potential reason for Modi's success has nothing to do with the successful mobilization of caste politics and also perhaps the assassination of people who could have mobilized the Dalits and other lower castes against the BJP. This concern is something that we are not altogether unfamiliar with in the U.S., namely the tampering with electronic voting machines. When in March of this year, this past year, I should say, the BJP successfully won the Uttar Pradesh Assembly election results, basically the state assembly results in Uttar Pradesh, they did so by carrying primarily Muslim districts. Now, with the BJP and the RSS, for which it is a cat's paw, being explicitly and overtly and murderously anti-Muslim, this is more than a little suspicious. I would note in this regard that in past broadcasts we had noted that Modi had been quite successful. When he came to the U.S. and to the Silicon Valley, he was oozed over by the CEOs and the top management of various Silicon Valley firms because he was going to open up India to their products. And I remember Mark Zuckerberg in particular doing a little namaste genuflection to Modi, which just, well, I don't like Mark Zuckerberg, and that made me want to puke, frankly, but maybe that's just me. So I would note here, and by the way, remember that Modi's election was assisted in part by Pierre Omidyar of The Intercept and eBay, a man who works with both the Agency for International Development and the National Endowment for Democracy, both cat's paws for U.S. intelligence, and a man who helped to implement the rise of the OUNB's successor organizations in Ukraine. Also a man who has had some very infamous, quote, charitable, unquote, or nonprofit organization dealings in the third world, India in particular. Those headed up by a guy named Roy Plosterman, who previously headed up something called the Rural Development Institute, which sounds wonderful. It was part of the Phoenix program in Vietnam. So again, whatever success Modi has enjoyed because of being able to successfully mobilize the Dalit vote, there appears to be more to it than not. From the India Today of March 11th of 2017, an article by Ankit Misra, A-N-K-I-T, Misra, M-I-S-R-A, Uttar Pradesh election results. BJP tampered with EVMs, couldn't have won otherwise in Muslim bastion, says Mayawati. Expressing shock and disbelief over the Uttar Pradesh Assembly election results, Bahujan Samaj Party, or BSP, Supremo Mayawati today accused the BJP of tampering with electronic voting machines, or EVMs. Quote, how come the BJP managed to win in Muslim bastions in the state? The poll results are very surprising, Mayawati said. Alleging that there was massive rigging of voting machines in the state to favor the BJP, the BSP chief said, quote, most votes in Muslim majority constituencies have gone to the BJP. This makes it clear that the voting machines were manipulated. Indeed, I think that certainly is suggestive of that, whether or not some of the Silicon Valley luminaries who were oozing all over Modi when he came here a year or two ago may have helped with that is anybody's guess. India does have a very vital tech community, so they may not have needed any advice from Silicon Valley, but who knows, particularly with the Citizen Omidyar looming in the, well, not the background, but having figured in the rise of Narendra Modi, the BJP and the RSS, for which the BJP is a cat's paw. I don't think that is an unrealistic question to ask. The RSS, for which, again, the BJP is a cat's paw, and which basically governed all of Modi's major political appointments, is the organization that killed Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi's soul must be weeping at what is going on in India. Not only is an agenda of political assassination going forward in India, but the following, I think, would make Gandhi absolutely weep. From CNBC, from November 19th of 2017, article by Nishka, N-Y-S-H-K-A, Chandran, C-H-A-N-D-R-A-N. Most citizens support military rule in the world's largest democracy. Noting that this, excerpting this, a majority of Indians, 53%, support military rule, according to a Pew Research Center survey released last week. At least 55% of Indians also back a governing system, quote, in which a strong leader can make decisions without interference from parliament or the courts, the survey added, noting that support for autocratic rule is higher in India than in any other nation surveyed. And skipping down further, supporters of Modi's ruling BJP and urban dwellers are significantly more likely to support military rule than backers of the opposition Congress Party and rural residents, the Pew Research Center surveyed. Again, something that would make Gandhi weep. Something that might make even Gandhi puke is the following. From The Wire, again, that is the focal point of litigation and suppression in India, from January 13th of 2017, a bizarre spin on the spinning wheel by Manash, M-A-N-A-S-H, Firak, F-I-R-A-Q, Bhattarjee, B-A-T-T-A-C-H-A-R-G-E-E. Modi has been posing with a spinning wheel in an effort to deliberately conflate his PR image with that of Gandhi. And again, Gandhi advocated spinning cloth so that Indians could wear homespun fabric and thereby circumvent the British colonial edict of having to purchase textiles from the British textile industry. The hit motion picture Gandhi from the early 80s has a good portrayal of that. I will also note here, and we're running out of time, the act of spinning itself was seen by Gandhi as a way of instilling spiritual and personal discipline with which he felt a person must be imbued in order to realize his program of militant nonviolence. And for Modi to deliberately pose himself with a spinning wheel when he is the head of a political party that is a political front for the organization, the RSS, that killed Gandhi, is absolutely grotesque. And again, Gandhi went about in a loincloth composed of or fabricated from homespun fabric that he made himself. And sort of capping off the grotesqueness of this, from NPR of February 20th of 2015 by Julie McCarthy, Modi's fancy pinstripe suit lands $694,000 at auction. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is noted for making bold statements both in policy and fashion. When Modi sported a suit with pinstripes that spelled out his name in tiny gold lettering, critics called it the height of vanity. Some reports claim the suit cost nearly ₹1 million or $16,000. Again, notice that Modi prided himself as a one-time humble tea seller. The controversial suit raised more than eyebrows. It sold at auction today for nearly $695,000. Again, Gandhi went about clothed in a loincloth from fabric he spun himself. Modi, not so much. This concludes For the Record program number 990, Hindutva Fascism Part 3, Modi Operandi. This is being recorded on January 2nd of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.